The following is a production of DifferentBrains.com.
Hi, and welcome to Spectrumly Speaking. I'm Becca Laurie, your house autistic, your favorite flavor of ice cream, and maybe your favorite weather. And I'm here joined by...
Hi, I'm Dr. Lauren Gerber. I'm a clinical psychologist and author of Autism and You. I'm sitting here with my therapy dog, Giovanni, and just returned from a weekend in Chicago. How are you doing, Becca?
I'm good. I had kind of a quiet weekend, which was nice for a change. I did a lot of chores around the house, sadly, that had kind of fallen through the cracks for April. Definitely took a backseat for sure. So it was a lot of laundry doing, a lot of house cleaning around the house projects that weren't taken care of. It was good. It was a very healthy feeling.
Sounds good. A dear friend of mine just completed a doctorate in neuropsych, so I went into Chicago for her graduation.
Oh, is it fun?
So nice. Wonderful to see and seeing old friends. And I used to live in Chicago and now I'm in Florida. So it was a pleasure to catch up with everybody.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about our guest today.
Me too. I'm really excited. I'm excited that today we get to talk about sex. Exciting. We are getting edgier every week, I think. All right. So today we have with us Leslie Sickles, and she's going to be joining us to talk about gender and sexuality. Let me tell you a little bit about her. Leslie Sickles, LCSW, is a licensed clinical social worker based in Midtown Manhattan. She received her master's degree from Hunter College School of Social Work and has received extensive trainings and certifications in CBT, DBT, and trauma-informed practices. Leslie's areas of expertise include autism spectrum disorder, anxiety, depression, and trauma. Leslie provides psychotherapy, which often includes building social skills, improving executive functioning, and strengthening relationships. Much of her work focuses on gender and sexuality as they relate to the unique concerns of individuals with ASD. Along with individual and family counseling, Leslie provides counseling to neurodiverse couples in which one partner has ASD. She supports couples in enhancing communication and working through challenges in their partnership. In addition to direct couples work, Leslie also provides supportive services, including consultation, training, and coaching for family members, siblings, and partners of individuals with ASD. Please welcome Leslie Sickles.
Thanks so much for having me.
So excited to have you. So we're going to talk about sex today and gender.
Yes.
Really fun things.
Let's talk about sex. It's a song and a great topic.
It is a great topic. I guess we'll start off in the beginning, I suppose, with the number one issue related to autism and relationships. What do you think it is?
You know, in my work, I've really found that the thing that I think is the most challenging is lack of really good psychoeducation, good sex education. I think that oftentimes some of our young people on the spectrum aren't provided the same or really adequate information around sex education. A lot of times I hear people say, well, if someone's not interested yet, we're not going to talk about it. And I think that we're doing our young folks a tremendous disservice. You know, one of the ways that I often look at it is providing sex education or information about sexuality and relationships at chronologically appropriate times, but in a developmentally appropriate way. So the same way we might go into an elementary school and talk about puberty in one particular way that we may not talk to high schoolers about. So we're modifying it slightly, but we're still giving the content and we're still giving all the information. And I think that that's incredibly important because we want to make sure that our young people have all of the same information and have all of the same supports and understanding of sexuality, puberty, development, consent that we might and that we're hopefully giving to all of our young people.
I think that you bring up a very important point, which is everybody is going to need to talk about development and puberty and sex mm-hmm. in their own way and in their own time. And putting off the discussion isn't the answer, but deciding what ways and what manner to have that discussion so that the person can not only listen to it, but really hear it and take it in
sure.
is imperative. Educationally, that psychoeducation needs to happen.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So a lot of times my practice is primarily with young adults, so I'll work with young people who have no concept or understanding of kind of some of the basic constructs of relationship or sexuality and how to kind of identify or, you know, consent, I think, is a really big one. And, you know, I think when we're thinking about development, especially sexual development, we're thinking about if someone who's 13 or 14 is maybe starting to engage in some romantic or even intimate relationships, there's usually some wiggle room for someone to not really know what they're doing or to be maybe a little uncomfortable or awkward. And I think, unfortunately, when folks start dating a little bit later in their development or in their life, there's not always that same wiggle room given. It's not fair, but there's kind of an expectation that someone knows something. But if they're not given the appropriate or the correct education about it at an earlier stage of development, then it's really putting a lot of folks, I think, in on the spectrum at a disadvantage going into these relationships.
I completely agree. I really think that in the mixed, the neurodiverse relationships, the struggle is different from even in an autistic and autistic relationship and in a mixed relationship or in an NT and an NT relationship, there's always a communication difference. But I think the communication lines are so different in the two types of brains that when you have a neurodiverse couple, the arguments are different, if I can say that.
Sure, sure. You know, I think one of the things that I feel is of the utmost importance in neurodiverse couples is having conversations about the neurodiversity. So that might be, as you said, a couple where one partner is on the spectrum or both partners are on the spectrum. But having conversations about neurodiversity, about communications might be different. Some sensory areas might be different. I think it's incredibly important. And one of the things that I've found in couples' work is really that when the neurodiversity piece is openly discussed and when it's talked about in that way, the couple can kind of put their guard down a little bit and understand that both partners are coming into the relationship with really good intentions, that they're not coming in with any kind of malicious intent or trying to hurt someone else's feelings. They're coming in with good intentions. They're just coming in at something with a different approach or from a different angle. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, I think an example that I use oftentimes when I think about neurodiverse couples and how incredibly strong and wonderful couples who are neurodiverse can be is if you are, and this is my like one sports reference that I ever, but if you are on a basketball team and you are an incredible shooter and you can just squish every shot that you take, you're probably not going to look for a teammate who is also a really, really good shot. You might want someone who's good at rebounding or passing or really, really good at defense. You want someone who has other skills. Being with it might be tough because you're speaking a different language. But as you kind of work through your relationship, I think there are ways that that can be blended so beautifully and really can make for incredibly strong, happy, healthy relationships. It just has to be talked about that the approach is different.
Leslie, it's so true. When you expressed that just now, the genuine interest in being close and intimate mm-hmm. is all about having that deeper understanding of each other. And to have that deeper understanding of each other, regardless of your different brain, you want your partner to understand your brain and from what perspective you're coming into this relationship. So it just creates more intimacy to have the emotional intimacy as well as the physical developing intimacy in that relationship.
Yes, absolutely.
Here's my big question, because this is one that gets me all the time. I guess it's my pet peeve. So I'm going to stand on my soapbox for a second. Do you think people on the spectrum are taught what they need to know about sex?
So I think, you know, as I mentioned earlier with the sex education, I don't think that the education is robust enough. And I think in general, there are a lot of opinions on sex education in school systems and for all young people. But I really do think that for a lot of our young people on the spectrum, they're not given all of the information that they really need to be able to embark. And I think that goes not just about sex ed. That goes all the way from puberty through sexual development, through sexuality, through gender identity, to be able to talk about these kind of multiple spectrums of sexuality, gender, and ASD, I think is not always taught, but I think it's so vitally important. A lot of the trainings that I do and the work that I do is really to be on my soapbox too, Becca, about mm-hmm. the need for this education in a way more robust way. And as I said earlier, I think chronologically appropriate times in a developmentally appropriate way. So talking about it, even if someone's not interested, we still want them to be aware. We want people to know what's next, right?
And yeah, I mean, it's sort of that, you know, even if you're not interested in sex, and I talk about it almost in the same way that I talk about anything else to people on the spectrum, you know, there's a lot of anxiety that comes along with it. And much of the anxiety comes from not knowing, sure. You know, just not knowing what to expect, not knowing how to behave, all of the same social constructs that are difficult for people on the spectrum in everyday life are difficult in this context as well. And I think if we're not given information, a lot of us on the spectrum will make judgments by ourselves, having not done this particular activity before or whatever it is, or had the experience, and sort of prejudge. But I like the idea of educating so that it's an sort of an educated decision to make, that you either don't want to participate or do. I think it's super important. It also, for me, helps to remove the stigma from autism, because being autistic does not take away your humanity. So therefore, we are still sexual beings, and it's still there. And it doesn't excuse us from being taught what we need to know.
Sure. I also, you know, hormonal development is absolutely the same. Puberty at the same times, hormonal development is happening. So someone may not express, and someone on the spectrum or someone who's neurotypical may not express interest at exactly the same time, but it doesn't mean that that information shouldn't be given and shared and available, so that when, as you said, those decisions are being made about relationships, whether they're romantic or intimate, that you have a framework for kind of what that means and what that looks like and some of the roles to play in those relationships.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think it's super important.
There's hands-on learning too. I remember for about a decade out of my 20 plus years practicing clinical psychology, I was in a school setting as a school psychologist and had the ability to work with so many fine teachers who were teaching both the development and the sex education across the years. And I remember the hands-on approaches so many would take as they separated sometimes the girls into one room and the boys into another room, which brings up some topics for you as well, as I know you do work with different individuals with different sexual identities. But I remember thinking to myself as they were teaching hands-on puberty topics, like how to use different products for menstruation, feminine hygiene, taking care of your body, what you eat and how it feeds your body, all of these things, very, very hands-on with demonstrations and opening up a product, opening up the Tampax, showing someone what it is, how you use it, what the picture is, so that your multimodal learners in the room, those that wanted to learn by touching, by tactile, by looking, by feeling, by hearing, all had different opportunities to take in the information. This is, you know, years ago that I was in the school system, but I think that there's room to grow. And as you're talking about it now and in your practice, people want to learn, and it shouldn't be shied away from. It should be open dialogue, good communication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Lauren, I think you're absolutely right there. And there are some excellent books and videos and various things out specifically for folks on the spectrum to have different ways to access this information. So if they want to look more at pictures or do read about it, I think you're right. I think there are a lot of modalities that people can access this information, but the highlight of this is that they're able to access it, that they have it at their disposal and that they're given this information.
And I always, in my practice, I'm sure you do as well, recommend books for, you know, for acne and puberty. I love the Care and Keeping of You which was illustrated by Norm Bendel, who I work with on my books. And it just, it shows the funniest things with individuals breaking out with a big fat pimple on their nose before they have to go to school, and various other things making a topic that otherwise would be a little uncomfortable and difficult to talk about very user-friendly and happy and humorous and welcoming. And I think that these topics, if they're uncomfortable and they bring out anxious moments or feelings that you want to just cocoon into yourself and not talk, that the facilitator in the group is there to help everybody develop a certain amount of comfort with at least taking in the information in whatever way they would like to whatever level they are comfortable with.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely.
There's a couple of topics that I think we have left if we have time for, if you don't mind.
Yes.
First, I just want to deal with the gender situation, because I know that in your practice, you're working with, I want to call it the gender situation. I have nothing else to call it right now, because I think within our community, within the autism community, we were finding a lot of conversation about gender identity, about sexuality, about the difference between gender and sexuality. In fact, I feel like our community was almost having the conversation before it kind of made its way into the general public as a larger conversation. I think for us on the spectrum, we're a little more fluid with our sexuality, fluid with our gender, because we don't fit neatly in a box in any way, shape, or form. We like to make it difficult for everybody. But, you know, I'm sure that we could use a little bit of explaining for everybody about the differences between the different kinds of gender and the different way that people view their sexuality.
Sure. So I think, you know, when we think about autism, we think about it on kind of the spectrum, right? It's not this binary thing of you fit into one of these like neat little boxes, as you said, which I think is a good way to describe it. But when I think about and talk about gender and sexuality, I think about it in the same way, that there's a spectrum. So specifically with gender, when I'm working with clients, I'm not thinking about gender in this binary way of someone is male or female. I think that there's a whole spectrum in there. I think one point that we often hear a lot about is transgender, which, as many of the listeners are aware, is when someone's birth sex doesn't match their gender identity or who they are inside. And, you know, I've seen in my practice, and I think I will give this kind of caveat that my lens might be a bit skewed because my practice does really focus on gender and sexuality. I may see different rates of folks who identify as trans or gender nonconforming, so kind of don't conform to society standards of of these binary or even three genders. We're thinking about it again more on the spectrum, where people might fall in different points on different days, might fall in different points, or might just not ascribe to the whole labeling at all. But I do see quite a few folks who identify as gender nonconforming, they don't conform to a gender, or as transgender, and are on the spectrum. Similarly, I think we're thinking about gender, so how someone is thinking about and identifying themselves, and sexuality would be that piece of how we're thinking about who we're attracted to and who we're interested in. And so, again, when we talk about attraction, I'll break that down a little bit more. I think attraction falls on many domains. We can be attracted to someone who we have an intellectual attraction to, we think is really smart and interesting. We can be attracted to someone where we might have fantasies about them, but really kind of more of an internal attraction to that person. We might have people who we want to have romantic or intimate relationships with. And so I think, again, sexuality doesn't fall on the spectrum of you identify as heterosexual or straight, or you identify as gay. But I think there's a big spectrum and people fall on lots of points. So I oftentimes say that I'm kind of oftentimes doing work in the overlap of all of these different spectrums. That people get to identify in, which I think is excellent. And I like having these conversations because they are so vitally important to talk about, and they're the threads of who we all are.
Yeah, they definitely are. And I one conversations that I've had at conferences along these lines and topics, because they happen in our networking, amongst the community and amongst people on the spectrum, we all look at each other dumbfounded when these conversations come up, because we don't understand why it's such a big deal in a societal way to even have to do this labeling procedure and process. So it's sort of like, it always seems like, oh, they talk about that. Yeah, they do. They talk about it a lot. Like, we don't, it's not a conversation topic in that same way amongst each other. It's more like, well, this is what people talk about us, if that makes sense. So it's almost like the communication about it has, or the lack of communication about the topic has sort of made for two different sets of conversations, because they're not happening together.
Sure. So I think kind of how we started is this idea of let's talk about sex. And I think it's an important thing to bring up. So if folks aren't or don't feel comfortable or kind of don't have that outlet, I think there are many, many avenues to connect with folks who you can have some of these conversations with, whether it's peers and friends, therapists, or supports. I think it's important that we're having these conversations, though, because, again, they are vital parts of who we all are. And people don't always just fall in one, like, neat little box or domain, as we all know.
Absolutely. I guess I just have really one other question, which is sort of, you know, I always like to have people leave with some thoughts. You know, Lauren and I like to make sure they're having a conversation when they go. And I guess sort of the conversation to me kind of ends, well, we talked about how important this topic is, but what happens if we don't talk about it? You know, where are the repercussions lying for people on the spectrum when the conversation about sex is not happening adequately for them?
You know, I think there's a range. I think one is that people can have really negative experiences themselves. So folks on the spectrum can have a negative experience that kind of compounds maybe other negative social experiences that they've had, which can be very much like a trauma in their lives. But I think that might be one end of the range. And I think, unfortunately, the other part of this range that I've seen that is terribly upsetting is that there are legal ramifications if someone's not adhering to some of the kind of standards or societal expectations of behavior in relationships. And I think one of the things that's hard about this is there are certainly people in the world who do things with not a nice lens, right? They are doing some sort of malicious behavior. But I think in my work, what I've seen is most of the time, and, you know, I don't always want to say things in definites, but almost always, the folks that I speak with have no malicious behavior, but it's really lack of education. So they may call someone too many times because it's someone they really, really like, and they don't understand why the person's not getting back to them. And the person files a harassment complaint, or, you know, they may not have a comprehensive enough understanding of consent, which again can lead to tremendous legal ramifications and trauma, not only for the person on the spectrum, but for other folks involved. So, you know, I don't want to be doom and gloom, but I think there's a tremendous range. But I think from all of these examples, it just brings us back to the point of it is so incredibly important that we're having these conversations and that we're providing appropriate education to our young people. Yeah.
You bring up so many important points we could probably talk all day about. I know the topic of consent, I teach over at the university, both in, you know, the population includes neurotypicals and many individuals with diagnosed differences with their brains. And what's interesting, I use a little video. I don't know if you've seen it before. It's done by someone in the UK, and it's called Let's Talk About Consent and a Cup of Tea. It goes into consent being like a cup of tea, that you can brew the tea and make the tea and come over and offer someone the tea, but that doesn't mean they're going to drink the tea. And the whole video is just a couple minutes long, and it's adorable. And I always show it during these discussions to talk about and open up dialogue with some humor about consent, because it is so important. Mm-hmm. And as you said, sometimes the impulsivity or the desire to reach out to someone and tell them that they're someone you're interested in may lead to, as you said, charges, legal ramifications, differences in the way our system deals with individuals who may communicate in different ways. So it's profoundly imperative that these topics and the language be out there to talk about what it is that's important that you've brought up today. So, and it depends on where you are in your development, both cognitively, mm-hmm. emotionally. You talked about attraction. Is, you know, there's intellectual, there's spiritual, there's many, many levels of differences in our different brains.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, I would love for you to just tell people where they can find you and find out more about this topic. I definitely think it's an important one. I'm sure we'll come back to talking about it again, but I definitely think we've given a lot of people information. So please let them know where we can find you.
Great. So my practice is located within Spectrum Services. So you can find me at spectrumservicesnyc.com. So that's services with an S. And again, my name is Leslie Sickles.
Fantastic. Thank you. We're going to move on to a news story now. You're more than welcome to stick around for it if you'd like, participate in the conversation. We're going to discuss one big giant news story today because this was a big one. It kind of hit the scene and kind of grew legs, which was great because it is about the topic of sex. So in Spectrum News this week, or this past week rather, they had a lovely article called Sex and Other Foreign Words. And you can already tell how we feel about that in the community. And its little subtext is, people with autism fall in love, they marry, they even gasp, have sex, yet these deeply human needs have mostly gone ignored by scientists. So the article is written by Anne Griswold, and she actually talks with Stephen Shore about his experience in relationships and how he ended up with his wife and got married and the things that his brain had to do to kind of figure out how to piece together this really complicated relationship structure that was happening that he didn't know how. So it's sort of when you don't get taught, what happens? I thought it was really interesting.
Yeah, I think that that's a spot on article for today. And that even the kind of tongue in cheek, the way it starts out with and gasp, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. that's sometimes the way people start these conversations. It's, you know, let's talk about something. Ooh, can we talk about that?
Mm-hmm.
And then move forward from there and then be able to get into some good dialogue.
Yeah, I mean, he really, it's really was a great approach for the article, because what it did was it kind of led you down what the road looks like when you're on your own figuring out how to piece together all these little clues and observing other people's relationships and the way people relate to you in order to kind of piece together in your brain what might be happening in a social context. And that's sort of that same social blindness that happens elsewhere for people on the spectrum. So it was good to be able to read that and then say, well, where can we be filling this in? What could we be doing in terms of our numbers and in terms of our programs? And what are we looking at that we haven't yet adjusted on? You know, it talks about that 47% of adults with conditions share their home and their life with romantic partners. So 47% of people on the spectrum end up sharing their lives and their home with somebody else in a romantic relationship. That's a lot of people to not know about sex, I think.
Yes, that's a big, huge number. And everybody on the spectrum is doing everything. And this article says, and including sex. So let's
right. Oh, by the way.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Let's be real about all of these things. So it's just an amazing thing. And Leslie, you brought up some of the groups and things you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is that article, do you guys tend to bring up like current stuff going on in the field?
We do. We bring it up quite a bit. And, you know, I think one of the groups that is that I'm actually doing in collaboration with AHA right now is a once a month free group for spouses of folks on the spectrum. And it's been a really lovely experience for people to come together and be able to talk about their relationships and talk about ways that they've had to learn different styles of communication or have helped maybe their partners with transition of certain coming home from work at the end of the day or talking about foods and different things. So I think we do always talk about kind of new books or new pieces that are out. So this may be something fantastic to bring into that group.
Yeah,
I think favorite materials that you share that we should share with our audience listening.
You know, I think there are a tremendous amount of really, really fantastic books. I may have to kind of pull up. I have a book of a list of books that I use for neurodiverse couples. So I may actually have to pull it up because there are so many good ones. I'm not sure I can kind of say them, spout them off right here. But that's something that I could certainly get to you guys if you wanted to maybe even include on the website.
We'd love to. I think that'd be great. I mean, for me, the biggest, you know, job of this podcast is to be spreading information about many topics that affect women and women on the spectrum, especially. Mm-hmm. And part of that is making sure that resources and information are available. And that's sort of the place that we've been coming from, is how can we educate everybody about these particular topics? So yes, we'd love resources. I love them. and I will send you this article so that you can bring it to your group, because I think it's fabulous. And it's got a lot of the big advocates in it. Amy Gravino's in it. Also Matt Lerner, who's a researcher, is in it. It's a great, good piece for the New York area. So I'll send it to you.
That's excellent. Thank you.
All right. Well, I think that about wraps it up for today for us. Leslie, can you repeat one more time how people can find you?
Sure. So my private practice is located within Spectrum Services. And the website there is spectrumservicesnyc.com. So it's services with an S.
Thank you. And you want to be sure to check out differentbrains.com as well as their Twitter at diffbrains, or you can look for them on Facebook. You can find me at www.beccalaurie.com, or you can find me on Facebook and LinkedIn.
And I can be found also at www.drlaurengerber.com as well as LinkedIn. It was such a pleasure having you here, Leslie. I want to remind our audience, too, if they'd please rate us and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, we would appreciate it. And we love to get back to you on questions. So don't hesitate to send us future questions for future shows. We want to keep our conversations going.
Spectrumly Speaking is a production of Different Brains. For more information, visit us at differentbrains.com.